Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast titled Thermal Management Challenges in Modern Military Computer Systems. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Ken Grob, Director of Embedded Computing Architectures at Elma Electronic, and Mark Littlefield, Vertical Product Manager for Defense at Contron. At Elma, Ken is responsible for driving the company's integrated solutions. He holds a BSEE from Drexel University and has been in the embedded computing open architectures industry since 1985. Mark Littlefield is an embedded computing industry veteran as well, with more than 25 years of experience ranging from software and systems development, program and product management, and business unit leadership. His responsibilities at Contron include managing defense-specific products, supporting business development and sales through system architecture and technical solution analysis, and participation in various industry standards activities. Mark was previously a research engineer at NASA, where he worked on problems associated with computer vision systems for on-orbit autonomous robots. He then moved into the embedded computing product space, where he specialized in high-performance embedded systems for defense, medical, and commercial applications. Mark is a member of the IEEE and a graduate of the University of West Florida with a BS in Systems Science and an MS in Systems and Control Engineering. Our sponsors for today's event are Elma Electronic and Contron. Now for some short housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Now I'd like to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You can use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. Next important button I want you to see is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. And the next button I want you to look at on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the webcast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. This webcast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Now I'm pleased to turn it to our first speaker, Ken Grob. Ken, take it away.
Thank you, John. Hi again, I'm Ken Grob with Elma Electronic, and today I'd like to talk about thermal challenges with today's military computer systems. So first I'd like to address some of the complexities that we face with embedded system solutions. One of the areas is the rapidly changing technologies that we deal with today on our PCBs, on our payload boards that are used to drive these systems. And a few areas of note would be as single board computers increasing in functionality with new multi-core processors, things like servers on a chip now with the Xeon D multi-core from Intel or our higher power Xeon architectures that can drive quite a bit of total thermal dissipation. We also are focused on chip devices like FPGAs. FPGAs continue to grow with Vertex, Kintex, Ultrascale Plus, just to name a few. And we see the power densities increasing there. And then lastly, you also look at things like GPGPUs, which are used in these systems as well, which also can drive quite a bit of power. So we all have heard this acronym SWAP-C, and think of it just maybe as a term, but it's a very serious term relative to it being more of a concept these days than just an acronym. We're dealing with the reduction in size, the reduction in weight, and the increase in power as we implement new systems, and of course there's a cost associated with that. So as we look at packaging in the old days may have been more of a mechanical exercise where one was looking at how to build a box or a package to hold a backplane and a set of boards. Today, this requires additional system expertise that we're constantly needing to deal with the thermal challenges associated with packaging computer systems. And I can't think of an exercise today where we don't get involved in looking at thermal reviews and thermal modeling when we're doing that. So the solutions require integration of various payload boards, and these may be custom built by the user, or they may be a mix of commercial off-the-shelf boards and custom payload boards that are developed by a specific producer. So we have a sort of a mixed bag to consider. We have sources of the products coming from different places, and we need to assess their thermal characteristics and how we can include them into a system design. So in summarizing, heat dissipation becomes a key challenge in electronic system packaging, and it's something that's sort of in the forefront of the design practice. As we look at the levels that are associated with cooling, we, of course, are looking at a first level of the printed circuit board. They're the board containing the electronics that we have to package and plug into something like a backplane and then ultimately a box. And when we're doing that, we're looking at things like the materials that are used at the PCB level, the conductors, the types of heat pads that we have, et cetera, so we can improve heat flow. Also things like card retainers, wedge locks or shore locks as we call them. These are metal card guides. This is an example of this on the edge of the card to provide the heat interface point to the next higher level package. At the box level, we can be looking at things as fan-based convection cooling methods with different orientations. This is a rugged chassis we call our 12-R line on the right side that gives an example of a box. Heat sinks and fins in the enclosure. In this case, we see fins that are on the outside of the small form factor box. Other means like liquid cooling, which is also used and can be used at different levels, can be used at the cabinet level or at the box level. And then a new technique that we'll talk about a little bit later called airflow through cooling, which is a new method to cool 3U VPX payload boards. So advance this. At the cabinet level, and ILMA deals with small boxes, typical packaged boards in the Eurocard format, and then also cabinets. One may be looking at vertical schemes through cooling where the airflow is up through the cabinet or heat exchangers and or liquid cooling techniques. So this is an example of VPX ATR. We call it a mini ATR, a half ATR. And in this case, we're seeing convection or air cooling as an option. And in this particular case, we're seeing boards that are top-loaded here on the right with a air intake on the front of the box that allows us to pull air down the side of this box to provide a hybrid cooling technique. Conduction cooling is used also in ATR chassis that are being used today in today's systems. In this case, we've got boards that use the conduction capability plugging in from the top, and these can use heat spreaders and heat sinks and then conductive card guides. And then at the bottom on the right side, we're showing an example of liquid cooling. So which type is cooling is suitable for the system design? Air cooling is first one to consider, and this is best when space and access is not an issue. For instance, the air movers will take up space, and if you're considering this at the box level, in a chassis we'll have fans either at the top or the bottom, and an airflow area coming through the box, and then above that one would have typically in a rack they would have other fans that require space. Air cooling can be used in higher power or higher density solutions where you can gain more mass flow by moving more air through the system. And in this case, typically we could look at cooling 200 watts per slot, and in other form factors we can cool quite a bit more than that, and I'll show you that in a minute. This is useful for ground systems. It can be used in air systems. One thing to keep in mind with air cooling is it's a function of the air density. So as the air becomes thinner, it becomes more difficult to cool the item that you're trying to remove heat from. And typically, this is a lower cost option because it's less complex. Conduction cooling is used where environmental conditions are a concern and things want to be sealed, and often in rugged environments we see conduction cooling being used. In VPX, we see many of the target solutions being driven towards the conduction-cooled packaging technique or design technique. And this is because those things typically work in a rugged environment. Here, the enclosure design's considered very early in the system design optimization, and the whole thermal premise is considered early, with power budgets, power distribution, and total dissipated power of the devices being considered. We might be limited here, or we are, to a power density, and that level starts to emerge at about 65 watts a slot, although it can be made higher depending on how the optimization can take place. So we might be able to see a limit up at the 75 to 90 watt range. But we like the 65 watt as a typical rule of thumb. In this case, there's fewer moving parts as the heat's transferred through the thermal pads in the box, and in this case out to the walls from the edge of the cards, and then dissipated either through convection or radiation. Lastly, the most expensive way to do it is with liquid cooling, which is could be required, and this is required when thermal densities are high. There's a few different ways to do it. One way would be to do it would be called a method called spray cooling, and then there's some other techniques that are also used in liquid cooling. Liquid cooling can be used where liquid is passed through the outside of a box through a heat exchanger to draw heat off of the components using another medium besides air. So some of the challenges, it all gets down to power density per card. So if we look at one of the areas that we're focusing today in new designs would be VPX. So if you look quickly at what you can actually generate for power, in three cases, if you consider the 12-volt case where we're taking all the power from 12 volts, one could generate 276 watts per card. We already said that maybe the effective range for conduction cooling would be in the 65 to 90 watt area. So it's clear that you can source much more power into the card than you can actually effectively eliminate. So this is one thing to keep in mind. So we're not gated. Like in VMV, we were gated by the total amount of power. And in this case, we're not. So we have the capability to source quite a bit of power in each case, in the 3U case and the 6U case. 6U case, 384 watts, and with different voltage rails, this can even be higher. So one needs to consider the cooling method, how we're going to cool the solution, what the swap goals are, and then the design that will affect the supported temperature profile that one needs to consider for the ultimate solution. So here is a method that is used by designers of computer packaging, and what we do to solve the thermal problem is do something called a thermal model, and this is accomplished with computational fluid dynamic tools. And a couple of tools that are out there are FlowTherm and IcePack, and we use at Elmo, we typically use FlowTherm. And what this requires is a 3D mechanical model of the system at first to be fed and tied into the 3D thermal modeling tool. So on the right side, this is a typical thermal graph with a distribution that's shown for an ATCA chassis that shows you where the hot spots are across the graph. So you can see the scale on the right side, and then the hotter temperatures are shown in red, and the cooler temperatures are shown in the lighter colors. So if we're looking at air cooled as a method, typically what we're doing is we're drawing air up through the chassis, which is shown here, across the boards and then out exhausting it. So cool air coming in from, in this case, the bottom and drawn up through the top and then out the back. And one would also need to consider whether you have active components on your rear transition cards. In this case, this is an ATCA example. So in this case, we're using fans. We can use fans in a pull-only mode or a push mode. Sometimes in push-pull, which is an effective way to move air through and over the cards. In ATCA, with these techniques, we can cool 500 or 600 watts or higher per slot. And ATCA is a form factor that's used in military systems. It's used on shipboard systems and has been able to be ruggedized in some of these designs. So what are some of the issues here? One is noise. Lots of times there's a noise specification where you're limited in how much noise you can produce, and as you move the fan blades more quickly and the pitch of the blades changes, the noise goes up. So the other note is that the fans are dependent on the air density, and as the air becomes thinner, then it becomes more difficult to cool, and then you need to have the fan working harder, and eventually it's going to become less efficient. And then how much space you actually have to mount the fan and the plenum spaces that you require in the design. So conduction cooling, or in VITA terms, VITA 48.2 is the standard that discusses that. This is the method that's used quite often in VPX. And the design that's being shown here to the right is a two-slot box that, and this is a cross-section of it to the in the bottom right-hand side of the slide, where it shows a sealed chassis. So we have a sealed chamber, and we have the cards mounting in this area to the left side of the wall. This is the card guide, and this is where the card retainer clamps to allow the card to dissipate the heat. And then to the outside of the box, you see fins that are created to both radiate and convect heat as air flows up through the fins to remove the air away, or remove the heat away from the package. So in this case, we're using a retaining lock to contact the channel and the card to make a heat path. And the box then forms, in essence, a cold plate. Ultimately, what we'd like to have is a plate that's colder so we can mount this box to something that's got a constant temperature. But quite in reality, that's typically not what occurs. And we're not given a surface where we can take the heat from the box, clamp it, and move it out and away from the box with the cold plate. Typically, we have an unknown temperature at the plate surface, and that we have to deal with the heat removal with the fin capability in the box to convect and radiate it. So let's see. I think I covered most of that. So I guess one of the limits here would be the fin size, limiting how much heat we can actually dissipate. So as we're trying to optimize that, the fin size would potentially be changed relative to the thermal load that we have to eliminate. So looking at how this process takes place, here's an example of a hybrid conduction cooling method. In this case, we've got a chamber in the center of the box that's sealed, and then an outside chamber that has fins. With the fins, we can pull air down the side of the box, and when we do this, we're pulling it with a fan, and this allows us to increase the convection capability or the removal rate of the heat from the package. This is something that we do quite often where we can tolerate the use of a fan in the environment. It can be used in airframe applications where the altitude is not too high, where we still have air that can be effectively moved down the side of the box. So in the process of determining what we can cool, what we typically do is create a thermal payload map. And here we're making a map of the different payloads that are in the box. We have a power supply, we have a GPGPU at 65 watts, we have an FPGA, actually a small one at 20 watts, and then we have a processor in the range of 65 to 90 watts in the bottom. So this defines our thermal distribution, and this is what then is fed into the model to be able to consider how the cards will behave when they're clamped into this box. And when we're doing that, just move to the next slide, we're considering the airflow that's moving down the side, and then we're also considering the maximum air, the sea level at temperature in this case at 50 degrees C. What results from that is a map of the temperature at the bonding point or at the edge of the card. And what the goal is here is to keep that edge temperature maintained at 85 C or lower. And typically, we'd like to see this be at 75 C, so we have a delta between it and the junction temperature or the chip bonding point, because what we're really concerned about is keeping the junction temperature of the devices at a proper level, and that varies depending on the device itself. In this case, what we're trying to do is keep that temperature as low as we can, because reliability of the electronics is a function of temperature. So the lower that we can keep that, the more reliable the overall system will become. So in summarizing this, we have really a goal then to keep the edge card temperature for something rated at 85 C at the edge at 85 C or lower. So if you look at it from the top view, and this is the same hybrid box, where you have the fan in the back, and you can see the airflow is being drawn across and down through the side of the box where we're now enhancing the convection capability. Again, fans make noise, and to give you an illustration of that, fans can make so much noise that if you're using these in an aircraft example, where you're in cabin with the device that you're trying to cool, it can be so loud that you can't hear. You would have to wear a headset to be able to be in the environment with some of the boxes that can be produced that have quite a lot of noise associated with the fan moving the air down through it. So this isn't just something that might be casually known to the users around the equipment. It's something that can be quite noisy. So ultimately what you end up with after you go through the modeling process is a temperature map, and this is showing the same box with the fan in the back, and then you can see the hot areas as modeled by the way that the temperature map is considered. So we have those four boards dissipating power into the sidewall, and then we see the relative temperature of that area of the package through the thermal model. So what are some of the limits? With Vita 48.2 conduction cooling with standard techniques, we're in the 60 to 90 watt range depending on the method. It's dependent on the cold plate. We've talked about the hybrid approach, which is convection conduction, and this is dependent on the mass flow or how much area that you can move. And if it was an aircraft application, it's limited by altitude. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to do is to control our swap C parameters. And when we consider swap C, reduce size, weight, and increase in power, this is driving our design challenges. So again, if we look at the types of devices that are affecting the power curve, we have three VPX processors in the range of 50 to 90 watts, FPGAs in the range of 60 to 160 watts, and this is where the game changer is happening these days. And then GPGPUs, these can be all over the map, but let's say effectively maybe 45 to 150 watts. So what are we looking to do then if we're limited by Vita 48.2? The industry's been looking for new ways to provide a cooling solution, and one of those new ways is something called airflow through cooling, or Vita 48.8. So we'll talk a little bit about that. 48.8 is different in its technique. This is a card model out of the Vita spec, and this is the card guide. And what this is actually doing is something quite similar to the hybrid approach that we talked about before at the box level, only we're doing it at the card level. What's happening is air is being forced through the card through a set of fins that are associated with the components that are on the card to gain better heat transfer so that we can cool quicker. So it uses forced air through the card, eliminates the card retainer. It uses a plenum to force air through the card slot, and it requires a special card guide. So as you can see, the guide has to have to actually have a hole in it, and the guide's actually sealed. Another point that's not really clear here is that the card has actually got a slight taper to it, so it's wedge-shaped. So when you insert the card, it forms a seal between it and the plenum system, which is part of the card guide. So this allows one to build new types of 3U and 6U VPX designs. And the requirements, what we're challenged with from a packaging point of view, is new chassis designs, a wedge-shaped card to seal the air inlet. We need gaskets, and we need new types of card guides. So this affects the card payload builder, and it also affects the chassis maker in how to implement the total solution. And one other point would be that the pitch changes from 1 inch to 1.2 or 1.5, so we have something that's thicker because the fin capability inside. So first step that we're looking at in this development would be new lab boxes and test boxes to prove out the concept. And this is a little concept box that we're working on at ELMA. And below that is a 48.8-based lab chassis where we're actually 3D printing the card guides and the test module boards to check fit. So we're in the process of developing these new tools to be able to take this technique to market and provide it to the ecosystem. So we're working on new chassis to support new card pitches. which are not current standards and develop, actually, which are current standards now, but are just emanating, and develop compatible backplanes and the work on new thermal models for this. So what you can achieve with this is you can basically double the thermal density that we've got today. So we could be looking at being able to cool a car that would be like in the 130, maybe as high as 160 watts, but much better than we can do with just the traditional conduction cooling means. So in summary, today's VPX systems can input more power than they can effectively cool. Thermal solutions must be addressed in the system early in the design process, and this is occurring in almost everything that we do today. Air-cooled systems can't be used in all applications, so we're limited where we can use air and then the methods that we can use air, as we discussed. And then we have hard limits with conduction cooling because of the 85C edge limit that we've got and the ability to transfer heat through materials effectively, et cetera. So lastly, we've got new techniques on the horizon, such as airflow through cooling. And this is looking promising for things that are swap seat constrained, like rotary aircraft or UAVs, also for applications like ISR or radar. And ELMA now is working on those concepts to help us be able to reach sort of the next thermal set of challenges that we're dealing with today. So that concludes what I have prepared. I'll turn it back over to you, John.
Thanks, Ken. Good presentation. And before I turn it over to our next speaker, I want to remind the audience to keep those questions coming in. As soon as Mark is done with his presentation, we'll start the Q&A, and you can start to ask these experts your questions. So without further ado, Mark, you're up.
Excellent. Thank you, John. So my name is Mark Littlefield. I'm a vertical product manager for defense at Contron. I'm actually here with my colleague, Simon Parrott. He's our lead thermal and structural engineer here at Contron. What we're going to talk to you today is a little bit about some of the challenges for small form factor defense systems, some of the lessons that we've learned over the last few years, and just kind of share a little bit of what we learned and some of our experience so that you guys can build successfully and deploy small systems. So quick agenda, we'll talk a little bit about some of the fundamentals. We'll talk about specifics of thermal management strategy. We'll then go on to some examples of thermal analysis that we've done under different conditions, why we did them, and so on. We want to look at some of the environmental effects that can play a role in a successful thermal design. And then we'll wrap up with some of the problems and, I guess, rules of thumb for deploying a system and making sure that it performs the way it's intended. So starting with the fundamentals, the key question is whether your system will meet the performance requirements it's intended to meet in the environment that it's deployed in. Naturally, the first place you would look is at to understand the fundamentals of the system's internal thermal performance. That is, what are the heat producers, what are the thermal paths that are in the system, and so on. And while that's important, that's only kind of the first stage. Beyond that, you need to look at things like the little more along the line of the environment that the system is going into, what it's being mounted to, the platform, the interface characteristics of what it's being mounted to, the orientation that the unit's being mounted, what the localized air is like, what sort of air exchange you can expect. What sort of radiation exchange? If a unit is in an equipment bay and there's other equipment in there, not only is the other equipment heating up the air around, but they're also radiating to each other. You have altitude requirements. As Ken mentioned, altitude has a big effect on the cooling ability of air. Solar loading is another thing to consider. But also, you can even stretch down to the application level. Things like what are acceptable performance limits and whether or not the system can degrade its performance to maintain an optimal thermal characteristic and thus maintaining the reliability and the long-term life of the system in deployment. And then you know, whether to understand all of the service modes within the system, because many times systems are multimodal. They can, under some conditions, generate lots of heat, under other conditions, not generate much at all. And then lastly, one thing to remember, it's easy to forget, is that systems not only have to work in their operational mode, but also in a test environment. We'll talk a little bit about that later in the presentation. So at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass you over to my colleague, Simon, who's going to talk in a little bit more detail. And so, Simon, here you go.
Thanks, Mark. Excellent. So first, over the next few slides, I'm going to take a look at the kind of characteristics we consider at the system thermal performance level, essentially the internal characteristics. And basically, we break them into sort of three areas. The primary heat sources, you know, examples being CPU, GPU, high power switch chips, things like that. Also, as Ken mentioned earlier, we consider the component thermal sensitivity, such as the maximum case temperatures it can endure and things of that type. We then study those heat paths from the primary heat sources to the internal surface walls of the enclosure. And then at that point, we take a look at what I call the secondary heat sources with inside the box. And lastly, we look at some of the components that are essentially just placed on boards. And because they dissipate fairly low power levels, they're just conducting heat through natural convection and radiation with inside the box. We also get involved in sensitivity analysis, looking at the overall performance of the box with its interface into the environment. So there's sort of two levels. One, the conduction of components to the enclosure, and then how it reacts within the designated environment. Now, as we take a look inside the box, I have a couple of examples here. As I mentioned, some of the primary components, what we're looking at here is a cross-section view of one of our Cobalt piece of equipment, which is essentially a ruggedized computer system. And in this case, this is one of the larger power sources in the box. And we have a CPU, maybe in the sort of 17 to 30 watt range, depending on its configuration. And this is located in the center of the image here, just below the red section of the arrow, which is effectively indicating the thermal path out. Now, from there, the heat is conducted through a very thin layer of phase change material, which provides good thermal conductivity between the chip die surface and this copper heat spreader, which you see next in the copper color. From there, we're essentially going through another thermal interface material, a TIM, usually in about the sort of 20 to 40,000 thick range, and that's conducting to the inside surface of the enclosure just below those fins. So for a primary heat source, you can see we have a fairly robust heat path directly out to the enclosure and then obviously through natural convection into the environment. The next slide we're going to take a look at where we're studying the secondary component thermal paths. So here this is something a little less significant. An example provided here, we have a section through the our Cobalt system in a 90-degree orientation to the prior one. And in the center of the unit, we have a carrier board, which on the underside of that, it's carrying a MPCIE module. This dissipates considerably less power than a CPU, but it's located centrally inside the enclosure, so it's still fairly important when we have systems operating at high environmental temperatures to have a thermal path out. And in this case, where we have maybe a 2-3 watt device, its thermal path is one from the component to a thin layer of thermal interface material. This case, it's going through a thermal heat spreader, which is actually just located below just behind the arrow in the center of this image, the close to horizontal arrow. And then the heat is conducted, in this case, through an aluminum bracket or auxiliary tray we have in the unit. And that conducts the heat towards the inside wall of the enclosure, which again, brings the heat out of the enclosure into the fins and or through radiation, which is actually quite a large technique for reducing heat in natural convection. Sometimes a lot of people are surprised that you can sometimes lose 25 to 30% of the heat through natural convection, through natural radiation from the enclosure out to walls. So let's take a look at those tertiary components. So in this example, we're looking at some of the smaller surface mount components on the carrier board that I just alluded to earlier. And as they're relatively low power, there's not been specialized heat paths designed for those components to the interior walls of the enclosure. But essentially, we have the two cooling paths available to us are obviously from the chip to the ambient air inside the enclosure, which actually can get pretty hot, sometimes 10, 12, 14 degrees over the ambient air outside the enclosure. So there's the natural convection path, and then that would conduct onto the internal enclosure walls and then out from there. Or another possibility, depending on how much hotter that component is than its ambient environment, is obviously through radiation. And as it radiates out, as I've sort of symbolized through those yellow dashed arrows, are radiating out into the enclosure walls itself. So sort of three broad techniques, and of course it's good to kind of carefully consider and cover them all, otherwise one small component may possibly take down the operation of your system. The next slide I wanted to take a peek at is looking at some more slightly advanced approaches for optimizing the thermal design of a system. Over here at Contron, we use SolidWorks as our 3D design tool, and we also use their very tightly integrated flow simulation software, which actually gives us a lot of great capabilities, especially when we're in the conceptual design stages. And in this example here, what I wanted to talk about was we have a number of design variables. We see in the center of the slide there's a table of a number of criteria which the engineer can determine various ranges. In this case, they're sort of fin height, fin width, a fin thickness, those type of things as a simple example, or even maybe component locations inside the enclosure. We then use the software to perform a design of experiments. So instead of, if we've got multiple criteria that we're running at different variations, instead of running 30, 40 analysis, using a design of experiments, we may only run 12 or 14, possibly over an evening or weekend. These automated experiments, they run, and then basically, and there's an example of the result of that, a thermal image, thermal plot on the top right, and the slide here. And then if we move to the bottom left-hand corner, we see a plot of across 31 experiments in this case of criteria I was particularly interested in of the maximum modem wall temperatures inside the enclosure. And you can see there's quite a variation from low to high of those plots, you know. So this is kind of informing the designer essentially of the, you might say, the operating design space of certain criteria or characteristics, how they interact and perform with inside the system. And the rather kind of interesting 3D color graph, 3D surface on the right is effectively mapping multiple criteria and looking at how they interact with one another. And the wonderful thing is some of these new tools will allow the thermal engineer to actually, having conducted those experiments, select a request an optimum point on within that design space. So some kind of new interesting tools there. What this enables us to do is essentially characterize the thermal capacity of the box. And getting ahead of myself on slides here. In this next slide, basically we use some of those tools, and we also interrogated the thermal analysis software and basically mapped what heat loads we're emitting off the various surfaces of the enclosure. This helps us balance the heat loads inside the enclosure that are being drawn out to particular faces. So it gives us a quick feel of that for optimizing the design. Now, another area we were looking at lately using some new tools that I think may be of interest here is There's some new capabilities in CFD, computational fluid dynamics software, that enable you to do topology studies. And in this example, this is we looked at the copper heat spreader that I used as an example earlier. And we just run some thermal analysis on that heat spreader. And working with a product manager, there was an exploration to reduce the weight of this component, you know, obviously pretty important depending on what platforms you're running on. And in the next slide, we'll take a look at how that software kind of interacted and helped us improve the design. So in the top section of the slide, we see the original part and we see the thermal analysis, the results and the localized temperatures derived of that. And a little lower down, there's this rather interesting image, which sort of blue and yellow dots, which is essentially what we provided the software is we gave it some design goals. We said, let's try and reduce the weight of this part by 35%. And we constrained certain surfaces. We said, you can touch this, but you can't mess with that. You can also set up certain manufacturing criteria such that the software wouldn't derive a part that couldn't be molded or couldn't be machined in, you know, through regular manufacturing processes. And when we ran this topology optimization, essentially the geometry that the software came back with, just having given those broad goals and criteria, ended up with the image that we see in the center of the slide there with a considerable weight saving. When we compare those results against the original, very quickly here, the topology optimized part produced a 31% reduction in the weight of the part, whilst at the same time only actually increasing the delta T, the temperature change between the part, the cold wall, and the heat input source by only 7.4%. So we almost got a 4-to-1 gain there. And, you know, in some designs, this type of optimization can be particularly useful. The next series of slides takes a look at some of the environmental effects that Mark made reference to earlier. And, in fact, in terms of sort of guiding the design team or product managers, in this next series of slides, we characterized a baseline enclosure, just a simple block, and then looked at how it was impacted by various criteria. So the first slide, we're taking a look at the mounting surface. Now, when you're mounting an enclosure into a military or avionics platform, for example, the worst case would be mounting onto a non-conductive surface, obviously. Sometimes we're fortunate and we end up mounting on possibly aluminum spars, perhaps in an avionics platform that help conduct the heat away. And in this case, and this central row in this sort of plot of information, we can see that that actually reduces our delta T, the increase of the enclosure over the ambient environment, drops it down by about 40%. So it makes a significant improvement there rather than just, you know, freestanding. In the last example on this slide, essentially we have a what I would call a passive cold plate. That's not the the water-cooled cold plate with its own control system, but it's essentially the electronic enclosure just mounted on in this case, a 2-foot-square aluminum plate, which is effectively behaving as an extended heat sink on the box itself, but helps dissipate the heat and brings the overall delta T down by about 60%. So all very important things to consider in the mounting of equipment in the next assembly up.
Hi, this is Mark. We're running a little short of time, so I'm going to jump ahead in the presentation just a bit so that we can kind of talk about everything we wanted to talk about. We've been talking about, you know, with a lot of examples around our cobalt system. This is kind of some of the details of cobalt. We kind of specialize in small systems, largely convective cooling without fans, but we do also fan systems. But the techniques that we're applying here are similar. I mean, the same basic techniques are applied when we do kind of board level systems based on, say, VPX, like what Ken talked about mainly. But I just wanted to point out that the techniques that we're talking about here aren't necessarily limited to small box like cobalt. So some of the rules of thumb that we've kind of learned to communicate to our customer base, I just wanted to express here, because some of it might not be too obvious, and we've had this is all based on experience that we've had with customer deployments. First off, fanless cooling doesn't mean zero airflow. A system pumps heat into the surrounding air. When you deploy a system into an environment, you have to have a constant exchange of air in order to prevent the ambient air from rising above the limits of the system. You know, think of it, if you're putting the system in the shoebox and you're just sitting there and pumping heat into the air of the shoebox, eventually the air is going to heat up past the thermal limits of the box. You've got to be able to move that air out and replace it with air that's within the thermal limits of the system. And we've done some studies on that for various customers, and I just put an example here of, say you've got an ambient air temperature of 55 C, and you have an input air of, say, 53 C, and you want the air to be no more than 55 C around the system all of the time. In order to do that, you need about 36 cubic feet per minute of air exchange, of that 53 C air exchange to maintain a 55 C ambient, based on, you know, a system like the Cobalt that's pictured here. One other thing I wanted to point out is that even a really modest airflow across the unit can really affect its thermal performance. What we found with specifically with Cobalt, and we use Cobalt a lot in our examples here because we've done a lot of studies on the performance of Cobalt under a lot of different conditions. And what we found was is that the airflow could can disrupt a buildup of heated air above the unit and lower the internal temperature of the unit by quite a bit, even with just a real modest airflow across. And I'll just show kind of a little example here. Imagine if you wanted to put a unit like a Cobalt in an area, say like an overhead bin of a standard aircraft. Well, you think that, oh, because people are in that environment, it's going to be nice and cool. But again, the unit's going to heat up the air in that overhead bin, and if it doesn't have any exchange, you'll overheat the system. So you need some way to be able to move air in and out of the environment. Some other rules of thumb. Proximity to bulkheads and other equipment can affect natural convection. For using Cobalt as an example, we found that an optimal distance to a bulkhead or another piece of equipment is about 2 inches. If you shorten that distance, the cooling effect of the airflows, the natural convective airflows around the unit, can really drop off dramatically. So kind of keep that all in mind when you're deploying systems or planning for deployment. And also, you know, you're heating neighboring equipment, and other equipment is heating you, so don't forget about the radiative heating. And then sometimes these environmental effects can be non-intuitive. So, you know, simulation helps with that. But you should actually plan for some good testing in the actual deployed environment just to be sure and validate. Just quickly to wrap up, there are things that you can do within the at the application space that can affect the thermal performance. Specifically, looking at say processors, they have the ability to adjust not only the ability to adjust their performance, things like, you know, turbo mode in modern Intel CPU, but also what you're actually using in the chip can make a big difference in the thermal performance of the system. Math units and GPUs are big consumer. So if you're not using them, then you're going to get better performance. Other things that you wouldn't maybe think about, like solid-state drives, draw more power writing than they are reading, so that can be planned for. Switches often consume linearly with the number of ports that are being used. Just a nod to Intel. Intel puts a lot of features into their chip designs that allow you to kind of tailor the chip to your application to the environment that you're going into by adjusting the thermal trip points specific to your application. You can really tune things. And I'm going to skip through because we're running a little short of time. And then lastly, remember that you've got multiple operational modes. And if you take a look at like a high-altitude UAV, it's designed to operate at, say, 55,000 feet. Ambient air temperature could be less than 40 C. And so the equipment bay may be in the, say, 10 to 25 C range. It could be operating at that for hours and hours and hours at a time. However, let's say you're doing some maintenance checks in a hangar. Well, the outside air temperature may be 25 then, and so the inside equipment bay air temperature may be upwards to 50 C. And then you've got access doors that are open that are affecting airflows within the system. So you got to be planning for that. And then, say, finally, let's say you're doing taxi system checks out on the tarmac. Outside air temperature might be 40 C, and then the equipment bay may be upwards to 75 C or higher. So basically, the lesson here is make sure that all of your operational environments are taken into account. Okay, and with that, we will wrap up and turn it over to John for questions.
Thanks, Mark. Excellent presentation. Right for the questions. First one's for Ken. Kind of came in toward the end of his presentation. Ken, can you comment on efficiencies gained or lost by TMN selection for interfaces within the system? Do you have recommendations for TAM usage? Ken?
Yes, hi. Can you just give me the number of that one, John?
Number 10.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so, well, we do see this. I mean, if you look at it from the card supplier first, when you're bonding from the thermal interface on the chip up to the heat sink or the heat transmission layer, we see materials that are used there to improve efficiency. They're following like a diamond structure that are carbon type materials. The heat pads that might be used to conduct to the heat sink and then to the thermal layer to get it out to the edge is also an issue. We also see other methods internally being used, like heat pipes. So within the wall, we might run into a thermal overload issue where we need to transmit the heat more effectively, and then we have some designs where we're using heat pipes to manage the flow in the sidewall of the box. So,
okay. Next question: Do you use Peltier cells for cooling? If there are other restrictions,
we've looked at that. I think there's been a couple of cases where we've used these electronic devices to move heat. Again, you're not using a fan in that case. So in certain cases, they can be effective.
Okay. Next question is for Ken. Does airflow through cooling have a large detriment to front panel space? In other words, does it reduce the space for I/O connectors?
I think it can. Right now, the application examples I'm seeing are using all rear I/O, so I haven't really seen the solutions where we've tried to optimize that on the front side yet.
Okay. Next question I'm going to give to Mark. What percentage within the thermal dissipation can you expect to be from radiation to the enclosure?
Okay, I'm going to actually let Simon answer that one because this is his area of expertise.
So in terms of the percentage of the overall heat load loss through radiation, it varies on a number of criteria. One key facet is the outside finish of the enclosure, which impacts the emissivity of the material. So just a quick example, if you went through a brushed aluminum, the emissivity can be about 0.04 to 0.08. And when you move that to, say, a black anodized, the number's typically more in about the 0.8 region, with a perfect black body being 1.0, so that's the scale 0 through 1. So when you factor that in, the other criteria is how much hotter is the chassis over the environment in which it's radiating in. But I would say overall, most of our analysis indicates it's somewhere between about 25 and 40% for a natural radiation cooled device, or natural convection cooled device. Obviously, with a forced air-cooled product, this is much less important. I think those are the key characteristics.
Another one for Simon. Simon, in the case where the heat is moving through phase change, CU spreader and TIM to the finned wall, what is the limiting component of heat flow?
That's a great question.
Yeah,
obviously. Well, the engineer, you're trying to avoid any major bottlenecks or what, thermal bottlenecks or what you consider weakest links. So the highest power density is between the die surface and usually the heat spreader, you know, where we're trying to spread that thermal load out wide. And that's where usually we use the phase state change, which is only like 1, 2, 3 thousandths. So there's hardly any temperature drop across there. You can barely measure it. What I would say is as we go from there, in the example we provided, we're going through a large copper heat spreader, or we could possibly use a vapor chamber. We didn't use that example here today. And then at that point, the power density is brought down pretty low. It might be 1 or 2 watts per square inch. And so the thermal interface material used then is somewhat less critical between that and the inside surface and the enclosure wall. And I would say overall the biggest temperature gradient is between the fins in a natural convection box, the fins and the outside environment. You might see somewhere between 12 and 20 degree C delta, you know, depending on a lot of different criteria. So hopefully that answers the question.
And I got a question here from Mark that kind of came in before his slides are over, but addressed by one of his last slides. So are the chip FPGA designers like Intel and Xilinx adding thermal management features to their products down the road that will benefit military systems? Can you give examples? Is there anything you want to add to that last slide, Mark, with regards to that question?
The slides I think will be made available so people can take a look at the parts that I kind of skimmed over. But Intel and basically all the chip makers are taking this very seriously and putting a lot of features into their chipsets and FPGA as well. So I would say, you know, take a look at your vendor, take a look at the data sheets and you know, understand what features are available there. Because this is such an important topic for Contron exposes all of those features of the Intel chips that we provide or that we use in our products and our systems, so that we want to make them useful to our customers. And so I would say take a look at the presentation and then take a look at your vendor's technical materials.
Okay, I've got time for just one or two more questions. This one was not assigned, so I'll let you guys pick who wants to answer it. As the hybrid approach is limited with air density and airflow due to altitude, what can be done to provide sufficient airflow independent of altitude and air density? For example, would connecting additional structural components such as elbow-shaped parts and hoses to the fan inlet to provide air be effective? Let's talk about airflow. Ken, is this you?
So I can comment somewhat on that. We see in those designs like a ducting or venting taking place in different applications, like in an air family application, then the designers are ultimately getting towards mass flow. So you've got like a pressure issue, you know, what you can do to force enough of the available air through the system. So there would be techniques that we see where it's the air ducting scheme is fitted to the chassis and then routed through whatever the vehicle is that you're working with that can help that.
Mark, anything you want to add, or we'll leave it at that? Okay, last question. Go ahead, Mark. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Just this is Simon Parrott here, Contron. Yeah. So just one other thought. We haven't used them lately, but I believe in the cooling fans, some are actually designed such that in higher altitudes, their overall RPM considerably increases. You know, the average fan, when you just move from, say, 8,000 feet to 30,000, you know, in a pressurized chamber, you'll see it speed up 10%. But there are some fans from certain vendors out there that will increase considerably. They won't make up, obviously, completely for the heavily reduced air density, which might be at, say, a third or a quarter what it is at sea level, but they'll definitely help. And to Ken's comment about the ducting, there's some definitely areas that can considerably improve the result.
Thank you. And this will be the last question. Briefly, gentlemen, can you tell me, Mark and Simon and Ken, where we can see ELMA, what upcoming military events, trade shows like Sea Air Space or Exponential that we can see your products at?
Mark,
where
you want to go first?
Contron? Yeah, go ahead.
So in ELMA's case, we'll be at AUSA coming up in Huntsville, also Sierra and Space, and then you can see our products at our website at www.elma.com.
Mark or Simon?
And for Contron, yeah, for Contron, we'll be at not the same AUSA. We'll be at the Washington, D.C. area AUSA later this year. We've got a good-sized presence there. And as always, you can visit our website at contron.com.
And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone will get maybe back to you after the webcast with more information. I would like to thank Ken and Mark for speaking and Elma Electronic and Contron for sponsoring today's event. Please remember that this and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending. I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.